गुरुवे गौरचंद्राय राधिकाय धनालये कृष्णाय कृष्णभक्ताय तद्भक्ताय नमो नमः। सो प्रणाम ऑल ऑफ यू, वेलकम, थैंक्स फॉर कमिंग। समवन एल्स इज कमिंग, वी विल सी। एंड हैड अ टॉपिक इन माइंड फॉर टुडे, बट I'm also changing my mind now. That
Very good.
happens sometimes, right? Just to be realistic. But I don't know. Some of you came too attached to hear about the topic we were supposed to talk about. Maybe some of you don't even have an idea what's the topic. That's we leave it
We just
more
hope.
mysterious. So, no, actually, the change of mind is more like inviting you if you have any topics you would like to discuss today. Questions, something you would like to bring to the table. So the table is there, but this is a table we are sharing together. I don't know, I feel more inspired, like, so getting to know each of you through your personal inquiries and interests and trying to honor that, to serve that also, right? And I the topic I was supposed to talk about, I talk about all the time also, so it's not the first time I'm talking about. Kanupriya knows which is the topic. In fact, she's the one who kind of selected it. So probably she's the one hating me now. But I know she. But I know this is not the case, because why? Because she already asked many questions about the topic. So she has her dose of reply about it. And if you don't know which was the topic and now you're intrigued about that, then you can ask Kanupriya at the end of the conversation. And then she will refer you back to some answers we shared in previous meetings about the
I mean, she
time.
has to think now, is this by chance or
Okay. Now you have a hint of the topic.
So you open up now for other
Yes.
desires?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I was so touched yesterday from the airport to home. And then we lost the exit actually, and then we had trouble with time. And this aspect of wonder and this unperceivable power of wonder. And often, I don't know, in life, it seems as if a wonder just comes in our life and then we are in wonder. But actually, what would be our meditation to be awakened to wonder, to be surprised more, or to, I don't know, to curious. Yeah, so that wonder, we perceive the wonder more. So how wondrous mindset
What a wonderful question.
may
Yeah. We use these words on a daily basis, but we don't, in English at least, wonderful. But wonderful means something literally full of, or awesome. There is awe. Awe and wonders, and it's so necessary. Yeah. Thanks for the invitation to reflect together about wonder. Yeah, that's a good, let's begin with wonder, why not? Well, the first thing that I always like to remind myself and maybe others also is that in our particular tradition, Rupa Goswami builds his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, right? It's a whole book about Bhakti Rasa. So his main premise, his main proposal is that Bhakti can be rasa, because before him there were other authors, not devotional, but more aesthetic authors, who will speak about rasa, like Bharat Muni and Abhinava Gupta and others, writing a lot about rasa, but not bringing bhakti into the equation as rasa. So Rupa Goswami tries to make his case bhakti is rasa. And for that, he goes to the big part of his treatise, the beginning of Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He says, Akila Rasamrita Murti. Say, Krishna is the full embodiment of all rasa. And that line is his own, but that's based on a line from the Taittiriya Upanishad, which says, Raso Vaisaha Rasam Hi Vayam Ladvanandi Bhavati, which means he, and he means here Brahman, and Brahman means Krishna for us, it's the absolute. Brahman is rasa, and one who attains that becomes anandi, blissful. So the scriptures say that Brahman is rasa, and then other section of the scriptures say rasa sar chamatkar. The essence of rasa is chamatkar, which means wonder. So that's an interesting point, no? Because again, our whole tradition is built upon, we are called Rupanugas. Main work of Rupa Goswami, Bhaktirasamrita Sindhu, built upon this idea, Bhakti as rasa, God as rasa, Upanishad saying God, the absolute is rasa, and the essence of rasa is wonder. So somehow the essence of the essence of the essence of who we are as Gaudiya Vaishnava is wonder. Brahman is rasa, and the essence of rasa is wonder. So the essence of the essence of the absolute is wonder. So no wonder, no wonder wonder is so important, because it's the very essence and heart of the divine.
What is the Sanskrit word they use?
For
Wonder?
chamatkar. Chamatkar. I mean, there,
Chamat? Chamat?
chamatkar. Yeah, something.
Chamat?
Chamat is something that creates a sense of like wonder. Kara is the action, right? Yeah. So that which create that which puts you in a state of like, oh, wonder. And there, and in English, there is something interesting, which is, because sometimes we hear the word awe with A, double B, and E. Awe, and sometimes you say awe and wonder, or sometimes you may have heard awe and reverence. But sometimes in English, people use these two words like if they were synonymous, but actually they are different, because awe is more about something that you're in awe, but it's more like a passive thing. Like you stay like contemplating that, you know, and wonder, strictly speaking, at least from the English perspective, something that takes you to do something about it. That's why in Sanskrit it's chamatkar. Kar means like action. So it's not just passive surprise, but something that evokes some response to that which creates the wonder. In English, you can even make a play of words with the word wonder with A, no? Like a wandering sadhu. No? You should wander in wonder. No? Like real wonder creates wandering. No? Like you move, you cannot but move. No? Again, if the essence of the absolute is rasa, and the other is astonishment, that starts to move us in a particular direction. That way, Śrīla Siddhārtha Mahārāja will say bhajaniya guna viśiṣṭa. He says Krishna is such that the attractiveness, the all attractive qualities of Krishna are such that you cannot but be irresistibly dragged to dedicate yourself to his service. You are moved to give yourself. So much wonder, so wonderful. So I cannot resist. Literally, that's the meaning of Krishna. We say the all attractive is fine, but we actually mean like are irresistibly impossible to say no attractive. No? It's too much. No?
What means irresistible in Sanskrit?
Irresistible Krishnas. To make it simple. I'm not Sanskrit scholar, just in case. So don't come for me like a
I
like
like,
dic Sanskrit dictionary, because I'm not Monier Williams.
but I like that, like the translation, irresistible. That's like, wow.
It's like I cannot resist. And we are very expert at resisting so much, right? We have a PhD in resistance, right? So the only way to put down our resisting is being in front of something that is irresistible. That even if I go with all my defense mechanisms and fears and armors and shields, it all st the closer I get to the irresistible, it starts to melt. It's like I cannot but. So anyhow, all this in connection to wonder as the foundation of reality, no? Like our philosophy as theologians, like the foundation of reality is made of wonder. And that's what keeps everything wandering. When we say I wonder, not wonder like walking, but wonder, I like play of words, sorry. With O, it's also a verb, right? Wonder is like a noun. Wow. I'm feeling wonder, but I wonder about this. So again, it should evoke a response. So and it's not limited to Krishna, of course. No, we say, okay, Krishna, the irresistibly wonderful, irresistibly attractive, but Bhagavatam Vedanta Sutra, it all begins saying Janmadi Yasya Jataha. Janmadi Yasya Jataha means the absolute is the source from which everything emanates. So the idea is if the source is irresistibly attractive, whatever emanates from that source also possesses wonder, right? If the source is made of wonder, everything else is wonderful also. Sometimes we are wonderfully distracted and we lose sight of that fact. And that's when things stop getting, I mean, they are still wonderful. We can become wonderfully distracted. That's what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 2:29. Acharya, he says, those who hear about the soul, they say the soul is wonderful. Those who see the soul, they say the soul is wonderful. And so on, no? Like saying, you are wonderful, each one of you, who you are. You are not your own creation, so you have no reason to become proud. But I happen to be wonderful because of the Atma that I am. But then he ends, but even more wonderful than all of that is that some people cannot see this at all. That's real wonder.
Difficult.
Right? That's the last note in which Krishna finishes. Like, soul is wonderful. Those who see the soul say it's wonderful. Those who hear about this, those who hear about even the soul without realizing it, still say wonderful. But even more wonderful is some people do not get it. That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Horribly wonderful, but that's to say. So in one sense, wonder is all over the place. But sometimes we are nowhere. So it's all over the place, but we cannot pursue. There is one nice verse that I always like to quote in Brihad Bhagavatamrita. And Sanatana Goswami says, if you learn to relate to a blade of grass, have the example here, there are a few zillions blades of grass here. You'll learn to relate to one blade of grass for what the blade of grass actually is. You attain all perfection. It's very like enigmatic line, not like all perfection waiting for me in a blade of grass. Well, yes, but you need to see the blade of grass for it, what it actually is, because we see a blade of grass, but ultimately it's something wonderful. It's something that emanates from the all wonderful, from the all attractive. It's an embassy of God. Krishna is in every atom, so it's hosting every blade of grass is hosting the sweet absolute. Now, of course, we don't have the eyes to see that. That's why the whole sadhana process is to start to see, to learn to see. That's why all these examples of the guru are about making the blind see and putting the salve of knowledge to make you see, and Primanjana Churita Bhakti Vilochane. All these analogies of starting to see, and then you see a blade of grass, and your heart is exploding in wonder. No wonder Mahaprabhu saw a blade of grass. Oh, Trinada Pisa Nichi. He was inspired by the grass to compose his most important verse for us in one sense. So yeah, everything is full of wonder. Wonder is omnipresent, as I like to say, but we're omniabsent sometimes. So wonder is omnipresent. It's in every single blade of grass. Sometimes we are omniabsent, so we don't perceive wonder anywhere. So it's the whole, I would say, practice is an attempt to bring our attention to a place of wonder. And so we can, that's another important point. So we can surrender, our tradition emphasizes surrender a lot, but sometimes surrender is a little bit like weaponized. Like you should surrender. Come on, surrender. Huh? Don't think, surrender. Don't feel, surrender. Don't heal, surrender. Don't do anything but surrender. Well, actually, all those things should be part of surrender, but anyhow. But surrender, many times we end up surrendering, quote unquote, out of fear, out of pressure, out of intimidation, out of fitting in, out of, okay, I have to surrender. I have to surrender. But ideally, we should surrender out of wonder. Do you agree, Anjana Manjari? Yes, okay.
100%.
Okay. So we should surrender out of wonder. No? When you are in front of something that causes you wonder, again, it's irresistible. You surrender to that. You cannot but dedicate yourself. For some time, we have to make some efforts. I'm not saying just only when there's wonder, I surrender. Sometimes we have to use our intelligence to. It's fine. It's fine. Yeah. I have. Yeah. Thank you. But I think there is a big part of surrender that has to be based on wonder. It's a voluntary act of dedicating myself to something that is to attractive, to beautiful, to. That's hopefully why we keep practicing Krishna consciousness, not because of power, prestige, position in an institution, fame, or whatever, but because it's impossible to resist. That's how we talk many times with Krishna Chandra Prabhu, and sometimes he will use this expression that I appreciate. He will refer to by the orientation to practice, which is more fear-oriented, like the path of regulation. And then Raga Bhakti, the path of fascination. So we have to be practicing in such a way that we become fascinated by everything. Not only by Radha Krishna Mahaprabhu, Gaurlila, Krishna Lila, of course, Shastra, the purity of the great sadhus, but eventually you learn to live life in a way that is, you can find something wonderful. Even in situations that are even difficult and painful in your life. It's not that it's just everything's wonder and there's some tragedy next to you and wonder, wonder, wonder. You can even relate to something complex with its own form of wonder also. It's not that wonder is only one thing. Not like wonder only tastes in one flavor. Like you have ice cream, but you have 108 flavors of ice cream. So you taste wonder. And you have also 108 flavors of wonder. It's not just, if it's just one type of wonder, how can you call it wonder? Right? It's boring. Yeah, I'm having the only form of wonder. That's a contradiction of the terms. That's not wonder at all. So we should try to live our lives as much as we can in contact with wonder. Yesterday, we were talking about how healing wonder can be, how. Especially in the times we're living with things become very mechanized and very automatic and autopilot and everything so easily provided. And we need wonder also takes us outside of the comfort zone, actually, because it's something we can clearly not control. Like if you go to on a walk to nature, to a forest, you know you are not in control there. If you're in your house, you think you are in control. Still, you are not, but you know where everything is in the rooms and in the bathroom, and this door takes to this room and this door. But if you enter into the wilderness, I don't know. But that creates opportunity for wonder because you are put outside of the idea, the illusion of thinking you are in control. So it's important how to live in wonder on a daily basis to understand, at least from my perspective, the importance of maybe making some effort to experience wonder, because sometimes wonder sounds like something very spontaneous and organic. But as we were talking, sometimes we are not experiencing wonder. So we may need to do some efforts to leave certain area of predictability and enter into some situation where we clearly are not in control. And then wonder can come, whether it's in nature, whether it is in exposing ourselves openly to someone else, that's also outside of the comfort zone. You don't know what will come, you don't know how will be a reaction, but there's hopefully some trust. Or like me now, like me starting a gathering, telling, "Boy, do you have any question?" I don't have any idea what you will tell me, so it's very outside of control, and I'm just improvising in one sense in this moment. I don't have a script of how I'll reply about. It's not that yesterday in the cars, Ramananda told me, "Maharaj, tomorrow I will ask you about wonder. So take your notes and have everything prepared so you give a nice answer to everyone." He didn't tell me that. So he took me by surprise. So that creates wonder. Oh, okay. Let's go. So So yeah, like Keshavacharya Prabhu said, curiosity, right? All these words are connected. Wonder, curiosity. We talked just recently in Rome, childlike spirits. Because a child is always like, exploring, seeing things for the first time, not taking things for granted, very open, very unfiltered, no masks, just is what it is. What you see is what you get. And that's why sometimes child get on our nerves because we have so many masks, and a child comes like, and it's like that's a too strong reflection of what I forgot to do. I became professional in hiding. So yeah, scripture invite us to not lose the spirit of childlike play. Play is another. All these words go hand by hand. Play, wonder, curiosity, childlike spirit. I mean, we want to enter Lila. Lila is play. The word Lila translates as play. So how playful are you living your life? Because if you're not living a life, a playful life, you won't get into a realm of Lila, which everything is play. So how much are we preparing the ground for eternity here and now? That's sadhaka, no? Sadhaka. Sadhana means the life of sadhana is living a life that is more and more coherent with the life that I want to spend in eternity. So gradually, the transition is so smooth that you never realize actually, oh, I went from here to there. You're just there gradually. You never. It's not such a big contrast that you were here and living a very, I don't know, rigid, straight line. As I say, sometimes it suddenly comes like a mothership and takes you to Golok Vrindavan. Everything is playful and spontaneous and full of wonder. And you realize, oh, now it's clear that I'm somewhere else. It doesn't happen like that. If we do not start to choose that realm of existence by how we live our lives here, we are not going there. Krishna is not that cruel to take us to a place that we don't want to go. And it's not enough to say, I want to go to Golok. You have to demonstrate those words by how you live your life. If I say, I want to go to Golok, but I live a life based on the opposite of what Golok is about, that's where you will go. And the Gita sees Krishna say, Jam Jam Bhavish Maram Bhavam Tejanti Antikali. He doesn't say, according to where you say you want to go, you will attain that reality. Right. You see, according to your bhav, to your mood, to your state, to your inner state of inner existence, that's where you go. It's like God's common sense, right? It's not so much what you say, tell others where you want to go, where you tell others where you are. It's where you are and where you want to go. Krishna say, I facilitate your free will, basically. We have to connect a little bit with today's topic, so I don't have that many complaints. So we have free will. So how do I choosing to live my life? And our Ishta Dev is Mahaprabhu. So Mahaprabhu, I like to call Mahaprabhu many ways. But one would be the God of curiosity, right? Because Sri Chaitanya is Krishna. Imagine this. This is a trailer of Anandadham, now. But Mahaprabhu is Krishna, being curious about his own heart, so to say, exploring the heart of Sri Radha, whose Radha is his own heart, if you will, the feminine and masculine polarities of the Absolute. So it's God exploring what's in the depths of me. And the whole Leela comes as a result of the whole Gaur Leela. So it's the Absolute being curious, basically, wondering. Wondering and finding wonder in what's the depth of Radha's love, and that has no end. That's why our chair says Gaur Lila is eternal. Because in eternity, Mahaprabhu continues to explore, continues to research, continues to wonder, continues to to discover something new. That's an interesting idea. Again, God is surprised. So he's leading by example. Bhagavan is leading by example. Live a life of embodied wonder. That's the God we worship, so to say. Not a God that sometimes God unfortunately is depicted or conceived in very boring ways. ways that make God unbelievable, but not unbelievable in the, wow, that's unbelievable. It's, I cannot believe that's not possible to believe, right? That, yeah. When I meet some people who are atheists and they tell me, I do not believe in God. Okay, why? Which is the God you don't believe in? They give the list. And I say, I don't believe in that one either. That's unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
Unrelatable. Yeah. It's unrelatable, therefore it's unbelievable. It's too much like, what does it have to do with me? Where is the point of meeting, the meeting point? No? But if we pay enough attention, how God is depicted in our tradition, Krishna Lila, Vrindavan, Radha Krishna Mahaprabhu, this is so, at least according to my Gaudiya bias, it's very relatable. I'm very human-like, very divine at the same time, utterly transcendent, very immanent, very close and intimate at the same time. And God is described as playing, wandering, curious, like always open to a new adventure. It's not like I know everything, I'm perfect, I'm omnipotent, I don't have anything to do. Here I am sitting on the throne, probably born, dying of being bored, but anyhow, here I am, I'm God. That's not the deal.
Work so hardly.
Yeah, exhausted, no?
But then it looks like he losing his control.
Yeah, that's a paradox, right? I mean that's the paradox of love, right? Like everyone at the end of the day is controlled by love ultimately. You know? That's the ultimate controlling force. And the control that love creates is not controlling like you cannot do anything, but you are inspired and influenced to do something. Like if you are a musician, right? And you could say, I don't know, I'm controlled by a force stronger than me. And you do something, I was like, you yourself wonder, like, was that me doing that? What happened? That was not me, but it came through me. Somehow I was there, I was witnessing that. So I was control, I was grabbed. You know? Again, going back to this, our ideas of something irresistible, something that grabbed me and took me somewhere else. And still, I chose to go on the ride. I did my part, but also there was so much coming through me. So, yeah, it's important that we rediscover wonder in many ways because we all experience wonder, but sometimes the tragic thing with wonder is you experience wonder, but then wonder becomes like a formula. What gave you wonder then becomes like a formula, mechanical, and then there's no more wonder, and you continue just with the formula. And the wonder is long time ago gone. So the question then is how to deconstruct all the formulaic approach to being remain in touch with wonder. Many times it's not about so much maybe what else to do, but it's not about doing more. Sometimes it's about doing less in the sense of deconstructing how I'm doing certain things so I can do them from a more wonder-like, wonderful place. I've seen that in my own case and in many other cases. Like, yeah, there is a time that doing something in a certain way was beautiful, great, wonderful, but there reaches a point where it starts not to be wonderful. And maybe it's inviting for rediscovering. It's like a relationship, right? I mean, practicing bhakti is developing a relationship. It's not just practicing bhakti. Bhakti is relational. So it's always in relationship with something, with everything. So like in a relationship, there may be wonder, there may be honeymoon, there may be whatever. And at one point, maybe I'm talking in general, of course, but something may get stacked, and that may be an invitation to rediscover one another. It may be a signal, oh, you're taking each other for granted now. You maybe put the other person in a box, and that may create the feeling of, it's not that the other person is boring, it's just that you made the person boring in your mind by putting them in the box. And we can do that with Krishna, with ourselves, with the holy name, with anything. We just have an endless array of boxes. This goes here, this goes there, and you put everything tied into its corresponding box, perfectly boxed, perfectly boring. Now you have the formula, everything is in board, the house is tidy, boring. Confirmed. Yeah. So sometimes we may need some deconstruction, some opening the boxes, some chaos, some disorder. No? One of my teachers will speak about order, disorder, reorder. No? So there is a time when everything needs to be in order, and some we feel order, established, balanced, nice, but sometimes too much order becomes suffocating. So I need some disorder, and it will come. Even I don't need to bring it; life will bring it. No problem. No? Things are getting bored over here. Look, boom, woof, and it feels like chaos, and we may feel even whatever concerned, bewildered, but all that is necessary part to. Okay, like the GPS said, recalibrating, and then a new order, not reorder. So all that has to do with wonder, not the work of wonder, to keep the wonder in place. Like the Rasa Lila, I always like to think, example, the Rasa Lila, no? Gopis are at home, doing the household chores, order, not following this order, disorder, reorder, no? Relatively order, no? Things are normal. Krishna plays a flute. Thunderbolt-like flute. Disorder. Disorder, no? Some gopis just run after the flute. Some starts to put makeup, as we know, all in the wrong places. So the eye, how do you call it? Well, the kajal goes like to paint the sole of their feet, and the red lac on the sole of the feet is like all over the. They arrive kind of like a clown, so to say, right? Though Krishna is charmed by that. He said, look, that's the uttam makeup. Now, that's the success of all makeup. Right? But it's disorder, no, it turns the whole reality upside down. And then they arrive to Krishna. So reorder. Well, remember, order at home, flute, disrupting. They arrive to Krishna. Oh, now we are with Krishna. Reorder. A new level of order, more vast, more profound, more broad, more beautiful. But after a moment, that reorder needs to be disrupted again to take to a new order, a leaper. So Krishna tells the gopis, oh, what are you doing here? It's too late for you, single ladies. I'm a single guy. What will the village think of us? You have all your husbands at home. You should all return home. Disorder. Again, that's totally disrupting because the gopis are like, you called us. Well, we heard our names in the sound of your flute. I heard my name, and that's why I'm here. You called me. And on top of that, we will hear you desperately calling us that you couldn't survive in separation from us. So it was an urgent, desperate call for us to come and save your life. I was like, if you call like emergency ambulance, no, like someone is dying here. No? No? And then the ambulance comes, like, what are you doing here? No? Why you can't go back home? No? And you said, no, you called me. You said someone was dying. So the gopis have this, they know you were dying in separation. We are here to save your life. Now you are sending us back home. What's going on? So this very disrupting. This Krishna is very disrupting guy. But with a good purpose. Again, he's not a rebel without a cause. So then it starts the Pranaya Gita. Now this back and forth, Krishna and the gopis debating. And of course, gopis defeat Krishna in debate. And they convince him that they should stay and they should celebrate Rasa Lila. So again, reorder. No? Another level of order. Or if you want to use union and separation, these are ways of speaking. So then start to celebrate Rasa Lila. Order. Everything's good. Now we are with Krishna. At one point, Krishna is like, he's getting bored, boring, not enough wonder. He disappears. Disorder, of course. No? Gopis are dying. Now they are the ones dying in separation. Before it was Krishna dying in separation, save me. Now the gopis are dying in separation, looking in madness for Krishna. And I don't want to go into each stage of the Ras that punch at the eye, but eventually, of course, they sing Gopi Geet. Krishna is witnessing that he reappears. And they again celebrate Rasa Lila on a new level of order. So again, we can see from the highest Lila of the Bhagavatam how this pattern of order, disorder, reorder happens. But it's all for the sake of wonder. It's all for the Krishna's to relish and provide the experience of a deeper rasa. And remember, the essence of rasa is wonder. So it's wonders all the way up, down, up to here, and it's about us to, yeah, sometimes unlearning stuff, and rather than learning more stuff, to simplify and take out certain things and relate to things as wonderful as they are.
This disorder thing makes me think, could that be the reason we have so-called suffering in this world? Know what I mean? Like, suffering is often going through something, change something, or you did something wrong, like in case of any physical suffering.
Well, yeah, the word suffering is tricky because there are different types of suffering. I mean, the gopis are suffering. Krishna is, I mean, in love you suffer. But that's not the same suffering you experience when you do not love. No? So we have to be careful because we may use the same word and apply it to different. No, I mean, Radha and Krishna in separation from each other, they're suffering. They're not acting. It's not like I'll make a show that I'm suffering, but it's in love. It's very different from the outside. It may look similar to what we know as suffering, and we may be like, I don't want that. But you have to understand that there's the paradoxical possibility of suffering in love, and that suffering can be sweet, and that suffering can be heart expanding. And I think we all have an experience of that even in this world. Like for example, compassion. You see someone suffering and you become compassionate, which means you suffer with. Compassion means to suffer with, right? So you are suffering now, but it's a suffering that you choose to enter into. And it doesn't mean you are a masochist, right? There is some positive value in not only some, a lot in being compassionate. That's one of sometimes the main quality or the first quality that in the list of qualities that define a Vaishnava, for example, Kripalu, merciful, compassionate. But to be compassionate means you voluntarily accompany other person in their suffering. And you enter Krishna and the Bhagavad Gita say that's the quality of a real yogi is he or she takes the suffering of others as their own. So that's not no joke. I mean, that's so it's a suffering, but it's suffering that makes you grow in love, that expands your heart, your consciousness. So it's a desirable suffering. It's not only suffering, but there is some suffering in love. So I'm just giving a relatable example in this world in terms of compassion. I'm not just saying rather than Christian separation, dying, they are suffering. Yeah, but it may be difficult to what's that? So I think we're all suffering, or we suffer, I don't know, someone we love died, passed, so to say. As a human, you will suffer probably. It doesn't mean that they stop existing and I'm an illusion. Oh, they are the soul, why you are lamenting? And there is a place for crying. I mean, my dad left his body some years ago. I cried. It doesn't mean that I'm thinking he's his body or I'm thinking this shouldn't be happening. At the same time, I was happy and I knew everything went well. But it was an expression of love. No? So indirectly that suffering or that pain or those tears or the grieving, yesterday we were talking about the importance of grieving when you need to grieve something. You will not grieve about something that you do not care for. No? So my grieving is indirectly speaking about what do I care, what is important for me, what I love. So that's one type of suffering. Now, the ones who come from being selfish and self-centered and exploitative, that's another thing. No? That's also, we can call it suffering, but it's a very qu different quality of suffering. So we can speak about qualities of suffering, right? Ramananda,
Yeah, there's a beautiful point. Compassion, together,
yeah.
suffering, and even grief, for example, this is so important. What you just said is an expression of love. No? So actually, what does it do? It connects you more.
Yeah.
It re the coming closer to the
Yeah.
compassion, you're now connecting more.
Yeah.
And the other suffering, I think, is more even disconnecting. And this is also
Yeah.
beautiful
Yeah. Exactly.
dynamic.
Yeah. There's
Which suffering is
there's a
leading to
suffering
what?
that, yeah, we could say there's a
To connect
suffering
you
that
more.
builds community,
Yes.
and there's a suffering that isolates.
Yes.
No?
Yeah.
So it's not so much about whether there is suffering or not, welcome, but what's the fruit of that?
Yes.
No? And I remember reading from one author that, well, that many of the strongest communities in history have were created in the context of a very situation of big suffering. Again, not to promote suffering, but just that suffering can bring communion. But also suffering, yeah, if not properly dealt with, you can be isolated. So.
Is suffering real?
Which one?
I have a daughter, and when she was very small,
Mm.
I felt she is crying not because she can feel some hurt in the body. It is completely mental or a projection. She looks at the parents to see the reaction, and then she cries when she sees, you know, yes, I am supposed to cry.
Mm.
And then the older she gets, more it becomes actual physics, before it's in the mind only. And then, because we take it for real, we take this reality for real, then we say, I'm suffering, but is suffering real? Is it only a reaction or something, or does it have a purpose?
Yes, there are a few questions.
Yeah.
Of course, I will say everything has a purpose, even if I will say, okay, I know that I'm suffering for something that in my enlightened state, probably I will not be suffering. To give an example, whatever it may be, it doesn't mean that that suffering it doesn't have any purpose, right? Because we cannot just force ourselves stop suffering. That's not what you will be doing in an enlightened life. I mean, we need to. I don't. For me, the point is not. The idea is not to stop suffering, but to learn how to suffer. Yeah. And again, we gave examples. Compassion is a form of suffering, and we need to learn to be compassionate. Course, if I say let's learn to be compassionate, we will say yes. If I say let's learn to suffer, everyone will say no. That's not the same. But this is, in one sense, it's the same. Let's learn to love. Oh yeah, let's learn to suffer in love. I don't like that, but love implies that also. Again, up to the highest realm, there is suffering in love, but it's a sweet suffering. So that's real. I wouldn't say that's false. Like when again, Mahaprabhu is suffering, tasting the mood of Radha. I wouldn't say, oh, that's all fake. That's in your mind, Mahaprabhu. I mean, I do not deny suffering is in the mind, but there is this material mind and there is spiritual mind also. Now, the scriptures say that in our Siddha Deha, our spiritual body, also have a spiritual citta, manas, ahankara, all these ingredients in a spiritualized way. So through that, you experience the things in an enlightened way, in the context of love. So, and of course, when we are not enlightened and we are feeling suffering for something that is illusory, if you will. In one sense, you can say it's not real, but at the same time, I will say you are having an experience that you cannot deny.
Yeah.
So that's real. What you think you are suffering for may not be real, so to say. No, like I don't know, someone is attached to a glass. I don't know. For some reason, I fell in love with this glass. I found my soulmate. I'm being extreme, of course. And the glass somehow disappears. Like a child, right? A little toil breaks, it's the end of the world. And Kanupriya got my subliminal message. And Parokshabad, in direct speech, she's getting. So for the child, it's the end of the world. Right? The toy is broken in one part. And the dad knows life goes on. But for the kid, it's true, it's real. Of course, that's been experienced in his mind, conditioned state, but it's having that experience. No? I'm not saying it's touching and affecting the soul and his soul is becoming, no, because as we say, that's a whole other conversation, but
People on this planet, like, they always ask this question, how can a good God create so much suffering,
okay, we are
Great
bringing me
suffering.
back to the original topic of the conversation. I cannot escape that.
We wander and wander of the circle which is closing.
So why a good God can?
Why does God create suffering for good people?
Well, the problem with that question is that it has an assumption, which is that God creates suffering for good people. So first, we need to question the question. No, who say that God creates suffering for good people, right? Because many times the questions are loaded. Now they already come with. And
I don't
sometimes that
mean it in the
happens.
most positive
Yeah,
way.
and I'm not saying you are saying that, but sometimes I receive questions many times that before answering the question, I have to like to deconstruct the question 5 times to show how it includes like 17 assumptions. And then when we deconstruct the whole thing, that in itself becomes the answer, so to say, right? So our tradition doesn't teach that God creates suffering for good people. Now the tradition says, first of all, we have, I mean, briefly, I'll mention that we as Atma, soul, as self, we have Kartritva, Jiva Goswami calls it, which is free will, basically. So we need to have free will. If we don't have free will, we are like automatons, like puppets. No? We don't make any choice, actually, it's all false. And people think like that. Maybe people think there's no free will. No? Even some Gaudiya Vaishnavas that I know, they say there's no free will. The scripture is clear about that, in my opinion. So, if there is suffering, are different options. I will mention a few trailers of what I was planning to originally talk today. Because sometimes also we can be very reductionistic, very simplistic in talking about that. We could say, okay, whatever is happening to you is your karma, which sometimes can be also a little bit like insensitive, right? To tell people, oh, yeah, that's your karma, that's his karma, that's their karma, or that's my karma. Or sometimes it's like, again, with situations, especially complex situations, like how to explain this? How you think that Krishna can control everything? Why he allowed this to happen? Now, if he's all merciful, all loving, omniscient, and supposedly omnipotent. That's a perennial question that's called theodicy, which is a whole department in theology which deals how to explain evil if God is all loving. And there are no easy answers, and it's complicated. So we can be simplistic and we can say, oh, that's people's karma, that's suffering. But it's not that simple either. I remember reading, and I'm in my next book, I will be talking about that a little bit. And I'm mentioning how Prabhupada at times, for example, say, one devotee asked him, oh, if someone comes and attacks me, and the question had an assumption, that it would say, oh, if someone attacks me, it's because it's my karma. So therefore, should I defend me, myself? Because it's my karma, right? Shall I, like, put the opposition or just accept my karma? Oh. And Prabhupada replied interestingly, say, that someone attacks you, that doesn't necessarily mean that's your karma. So it's in that, in other words, mean not necessarily everything that is happening on the outside is your karma. There is something called karma, but that's not everything. Krishna, the Bhagavad Gita speaks how in every action there is different elements playing out at the same time. God's will and influence, the jiva's free will, other people's free will, one's karma, the gunas, all in the mix simultaneously. So it's not just, oh, it's your karma. Or sometimes, oh, it's Krishna's arrangement. That can be complicated also. Sometimes happening something difficult in your life. Oh, that's Leela. I've heard about this resort to the word Leela like very quickly. Leela, Leela, Leela. Like canceling all thought, Leela. If the word Leela doesn't work, they will resort to the word, they will, if the Leela card, now they are playing the Leela card, Leela. Leela card's not working. Okay, let's see what else I have in the deck. I will play the Achintya card. You know that one. Achintya means inconceivable. Now, when you don't know how to explain something, oh, Achintya. No? With that, I don't have to think. Nobody has. We don't need to enter into complicated conversations. Achintya. Right? And if still the Achintya card is not working, you start to get nervous and you need to intimidate your opponent who keeps asking, let's play the Aparadha card. If you continue to ask that question, that means you have no faith, and that's because you have made some offense. You try to shut them down.
No? Raised in Catholic environment, same cards.
So it's not about, it's not limited. Yeah, same card deck, right?
Same card deck.
Leela card, no working. Achintya card, no working. Aparat card. With that, you cancel all possible conversation. No dialogue, no critical thinking, and you have a cult, basically, of blind followers at that point, which is not healthy. So to protect ourselves, we have to sometimes sit with complicated conversations, and sometimes we may not get fully satisfying answers immediately. Sometimes we need to sit with the questions. No, I've tried to think about that. There's one chapter in my next book, which ended up being the longest chapter, and I've been kind of like haunted by this idea. Like, okay. Krish, because my next, 2 years ago we gave a lecture, not here but in your home nearby, about Krishna loves you unconditionally. So anyhow, we are going to the actual main topic. So now I'm at wonder that topic is bringing me. So we talk about God loves you unconditionally. God loves everyone unconditionally. You can learn to love yourself, knowing that you are loved and you are lovable. Sounds nice. It's nice, but then I thought, okay, today let's balance the equation by bringing other element, which is, so what about suffering? What about evil? And what about if Krishna loves everyone unconditionally, why these things happen? Is he allowing them to happen? Can he do something about it? Not. Why, if he can, why he does not do it? Achintya, Krishna's arrangement, mystery, Leela, Aparat. Or what? How to think about it? And I was like, almost like for a whole year, like my mind was like trying, not trying to figure it out with my head, but going to scripture and praying, but also trying to use my God-given faculties to think. And I'm not saying I've reached like the perfect conclusion, but I reached the point that I'm satisfied with it. And I know that not everyone will agree with me at the same time, and it's fine. There are many things Gaudiya Vaishnava do not agree with one another. And hopefully we can live peacefully without killing each other and our differences. But for me, the thing is the following. It's like, yeah, for me, Krishna, I do not deny God is all loving. God is omniscient. But when it comes to omnipotent, I have like a, I will say, okay, I kind of say omnipotent, but for me, omnipotence doesn't mean God can do anything and everything. And what I mean by that, if God can do anything and everything, he could just like kill himself. Is that possible? Maybe say yes. Oh, so that may happen at any moment. We don't know. We will leave him freaking out that if at any moment Krishna becomes suicidal. To give an example, right? Or maybe if Krishna can, he will like extinguish the existence of all of you if he wants. Because he's omnipotent. I'm hypothetically, I don't know, I agree with that, but some people think that. So imagine you live your whole life thinking, oh, Krishna can at any moment erase me from existence. Of course, someone will say, yeah, but he will not do that. How do you know? Now you are limiting, no? So that's a little bit complicated to for me. It has problems if you play out the implications of that. So I will say, yeah, Krishna, of course, can do so many things. And we can say that's omnipotent, but there are certain things that God cannot do, not because God is not incredible, but just because it's absurd for that to be the case. Now, for example, just to give you a simple set of steps that I put in my book, we hear that God is love. Every tradition say the same. We would just say before Rasa Vaisaha, Krishna's Rasa. It's another way of speaking about love. God is love. One of the main features of love is voluntary. And we have free will. That's very clearly mentioned in scripture. The soul has free, Jiva Goswami in Paramatma Sandarbha says, free will is one of the 21 intrinsic attributes of the soul. So you cannot take that out. It's intrinsic to who you are. If I take that out, you are no longer a soul. But you cannot be no longer a soul. The soul is eternal, no beginning, no end. Krishna in the Gita said that which exists does never stop existing. So you exist eternally, you will never stop existing. So Krishna cannot stop your existence. So we have free will. Love is voluntary. Sorry if it's getting a little bit heavy and you have to follow my
Very good.
train of thoughts. Hopefully, I'm as simple as I can. God is love. Love is voluntary. So for love to be voluntary, we need to have a choice. So we have freedom, free will. We can choose. But in order to choose love, you also have to have some other option, right? If I tell you, okay, you have free will, choose. And you ask, which are the options? Oh, you only have one option. And it's like, that's not free will. That's not a choice. If I only have one choice, that's not a choice. I need to at least have two choices. Right? In this case, to be simple, is one choice is to love, and the other choice is to turn my back on love. That's why Prabhupada will use the expression go back to Godhead. Because you have turned your back to Godhead. So now go back to Godhead. Nobody falls from Vaikuntha. I'm getting in trouble with that one. We're going to edit that part, no problem. But anyhow, that's from where he took that from the Archbishop of Canterbury. He took that quote from him, and that's mentioned in the first issue of the Back to Godhead magazine. He explained this came from him. He said, it's time that we go back to Godhead because we have turned our back to Godhead. No, Antarmukh Bahirmukh. No, as Jiva Goswami used. So anyhow, love voluntary, we need to have some choice. And when we do not choose love, we have all the mess that we see in the world. So it's not about God creating suffering for us, but it's the result of our choice or other people's choice, as Prabhupada say. Sometimes you have your own free will that you can create your own misery if you choose unwisely. And sometimes you meet on a corner with someone else's free will, and that creates its own trouble. What to do? That's the price of love, because you need people with free will for the possibility of love to exist. If love stops being voluntary, it's no longer love. If love is no longer love, God is no longer God because God is love. So that's not possible. If I try to make it as mathematical, axiomatical as possible. So that's why sometimes when people ask me why we suffer, playing out that, I will say, you suffer because God loves you, which sounds contradictory. But because God loves you have free will and you can choose. And when you choose unwisely, you suffer. Because God loves you, all this chain happens. It's not that He wants you to suffer. Because he loves you, he gives you the chance to choose. But then, or others to choose. So, but again, sometimes our own free will, these are the three kleshas that the scriptures speak, right? Adhyatmika klesha, adi bhautika klesha, adi dhaivika klesha. That's another layer of complexity, but I'll throw it just to drive you crazy for a moment. I was thinking about the other day about that because recently there was, and I don't want to sound insensitive with this. It's a delicate topic. It's delicate and it's complex to understand. But for example, there was this terrible earthquake in Venezuela some weeks ago. Thousands of people dead. Confirmed like almost 4,000 people and like 50,000 people not found, which basically means dead. But lying below the ruins of the, so more than 50,000 people dying in like in 1 minute. So it's complex. Again, go bringing back that. Okay, why that happened? Did Krishna allow it? It was Venezuela's karma. No, because sometimes we can go that, why the Holocaust? It was the karma of the whole Jewish tradition or the, we can make this big. They are complicated questions. I can see the face of all of you. You are not like, yeah, no, we are moving from wonder to wondering in another way, right? And I think it's important to sit with that, even if it's uncomfortable. And our tradition speaks about adhyatmika, adi daivika, and adi bhautika klesha. Klesha means like affliction. Affliction, you say? Misery, sometimes say it, that come from. Adhyatmika means we create that ourselves. So with our own free will, I became my own source of misery. I think we all have experience of that on a daily basis. At least Swami Padmanabha has. I don't want to speak for you. Then you have Adi Bhautika Klesha, which is other bhutas. Bhutas here means other living entities. As Prabhupada say, oh, someone attacks you. May not be your karma, it's just the other person's free will thrown upon you, so to say. And you are, there's a meeting point of that, and it creates a misery of its own. It's not your karma, it was the other person's free will. And you just happen to be there. Let's put it that way. It's what happens when people have free will, because you need that for love to be a possibility. Let's not lose sight of that bigger picture. And then adi daivika klesha, which is natural catastrophes. That's another interesting layer, which is Mother Nature has its own free will. That's complex. Now we speak about the earth as a person, nature in personal terms, and there are necessary movements in that may go way beyond our capacity to see, but tectonic shifts and certain global necessary movements that on some level create a terrible catastrophe that again we are not insensitive to that, but also it's, I think it's important to understand there's something else going on here. And it doesn't need to be, oh, that's the karma of the Venezuelans. No, because that can be really cruel. And I've seen sometimes people like just using the word karma too quickly. Or it was Krishna's arrangement. No, or sometimes they think, oh, it was the karma of the Venezuela. But what about the what's the star like? But what about the devotees who were in Venezuela? For them, it was not their karma. Okay, it was Krishna's arrangement for them, which makes it even worse, probably. Right? Imagine if some of your family members are in a catastrophe, and first of all, I tell you that was their karma. You will want to kill me, basically. And some of the family members were devotees. Oh, in the case of them, that was Krishna's mercy for them. You will want to kill me a second time. So we have to, yeah, be careful sometimes how we use this. We think sometimes we understand karma is simple, basic, ting, 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 and sometimes it's way more complex. And there are other elements at play at the same time. And it's important that we understand the things deeply before we want to jump into deeper topics, as I like always to say, to understand the basic topic in the deepest possible way, So we don't go to the deepest topic in the most superficial possible way.
Even here could be this picture this of compassion of what is the result of the model of explanation? Does it bring me closer, to the truth, or does it put me away, or even to people, to other living entities? My explanation of this Krishna's arrangement, and maybe it makes a distance, and I'm not coming closer to you.
Exactly. At the end of the day, regarding what you say, it's not so much about ascertaining, I don't know, in any given situation, how much of this is my karma, how much is Krishna's arrangement, 70% and 30%, but the real issue is to respond accordingly.
Yes.
Whether to
Yes,
something
indeed.
happening to me, to something happening to others, are responding accordingly means responding empathically, compassionately, because if not, we get too much stuck. I mean, we can explain and think a little bit, but then inaction is, at the end of the day, is calling for a response. So, yeah.
But then if you go to India, where everybody knows about karma and reactions, you see that people take the excuse not to help the poor people begging in the street by just, denying, saying that that's their karma, they have to go through that. It's amazing.
But that's another example from, I mean, as much as I love many things in India, it's not that I'm an India blind follower, so to say, and everything that happens in India is great. And you can see how a notion like karma, which is absolutely ingrained in the culture, in one sense it's great. Okay, they are born with that education and karma and rebirth, but also the tricky part is that it's so ingrained that you take it for granted on a very basic level, and you don't care to learn it deeper, and then you end up like expressing or resorting to that idea in ways that are not fully sensitive and compassionate, and you become transcendental, but that's more dysfunctional than transcendental, because someone really transcendental is really compassionate and sensitive. So and I've seen that happening a lot. And there are a few verses, I don't have them in my mind now, but from the Bhagavatam where it is mentioned how, the response to, even if something that is happening to another person is karmas, let's speak about hypothetically, you are suffering tremendously and that's 108% your karma, still your response to that should be compassion. So it doesn't change how you one should react, no? Because the fact that it's, oh, that's their karma. Okay, even if that's the case, which we don't know, as I was mentioning, how much is karma, how much is something else, we may never know. So I think the problem is not so much, oh, I will never know. No, the problem is when you do not respond accordingly. It doesn't matter whether how much is karma or not. The matter is be empathy and compassion.
Is suffering softening the heart?
Is suffering,
Softening the heart?
yeah, that should be the question, right?
Does it do that? Hold on.
Hopefully. I mean, that's the idea.
That will be a good answer.
Yeah, suffering ideally should open our heart,
Yeah.
should soften our heart. Whether we see it in others, we are going through ourselves, there is a purpose in that.
So the purpose of suffering is actually opening the heart again.
Ideally, yeah. Of course, we can also open our heart without suffering. It's not
Yeah.
like, okay, you only
Yeah.
need, you have to suffer so your heart is open. But if suffering comes uninvited, so to say,
Yeah.
yeah, ideally that's meant to open your heart if you learn to relate to it properly, because you can relate to suffering in dysfunctional ways and your heart becomes hardened and you become cynical, fatalistic, like the whole world is conspiring against me. So many things can happen by not dealing with suffering in a healthy way. So, yeah. So it's, that's why we go back to grieving, which grieving in one sense is accepting suffering, internalizing suffering, and allowing suffering to open you, which is not easy. I have a friend who is a poet, and she told me that one of her main prayers is are two words. No? The two words are open me. She wrote a whole poem about that, about the price to say that in prayer. Because you say open me, and then you are opened. She says, yeah, I go back to that prayer, and sometimes I say a second to another set of two words in response to that prayer, sometimes when I can, which is thank you. Now open me. Oof, thank you. I'm summarizing the poem, which is way more beautiful, but yeah, suffering comes to that, right? Yeah, and that's how I understand, in a healthy way, for example, the famous prayer of Queen Kunti, right? It's not that she's a masochist. Of course, we can explain it from many ways. One way that some acharyas have explained is, okay, Kunti Devi, she's on a stage of prem called rag, no? Snehaman, rag, anurag, snehaman pranay, rag, anurag, ma bhav, mahabhav. And rag, one of the qualities of a rag is that suffering becomes joyful. Because you have so much love, which again, it makes sense according to what we are talking. When you have an abundance of love, what ordinarily will create misery, it becomes a source of, you feel closer to Krishna. So from that ecstatic place, she's asking Krishna to send more miseries. But then she says, Bhavato yad darshanam. By that, I see you further. I have further darshan of you. Of course, who can imitate that if you're not in rag? So a healthy way will be basically that. Suffering. I know that suffering will open me, and sometimes applying that to us, no, not saying that that's Kunti Devi. Sometimes I'm so close that probably I need that, I know that I need some suffering to open me. And I welcome that if
Wake up.
that's what I need. Yeah. Trust, trust.
Wake up.
Yeah, trust the intention of what's coming. Because if not, we'll reduce suffering to, oh, that's because you did something wrong, it was your illusion, and the consequence is suffering. End of the conversation. Oof. So we don't take advantage of the gifts of suffering, if you will.
Yeah.
So okay, let's say you made a mistake, you acted in the wrong way, karma, result, suffering. It can happen, but still, what do you do with that suffering? Because if you don't know how to relate to that suffering, you are perpetrating the same chain over all over and over again. So how you break the chain is by whenever suffering comes, you embrace it and welcome home and learn your lesson and allow the suffering to open you.
Will answer increase the hatred.
Sorry?
If people don't get an answer on the suffering, it will increase the hatred of the hatred.
Yeah, resentfulness,
Yeah.
hatred, cynicism,
Yeah.
they grow like bitter. Because yeah, they didn't receive a proper answer or explanation. And I've seen even not people, but even spiritual practitioners go in that direction because they've gone through some
Yeah,
real
experience.
suffering and they received the like, now it was your karma. Or again, Krishna's arrangement. For you to be detached from this, or for you to get closer to him, and they accepted that, because if not, someone will play the apparatic card again. But they didn't really believe that nor process that, and internally they grow like bitter. And at one point, whatever happens, and oh, what happened? So it was like a time bomb clicking there. So, yeah.
So, reminds me of who we're talking about this in psychotherapy. Often I see clients with this desire to understand why am I how I am. And often I have the impression, maybe it's a bit similar to this topic, that there is this, I don't know, illusion maybe, or this idea that just the virtue of understanding something will result in a transformation. So if I just explain now, this is karma, or this is this, as if now we have the perfect explanation, this will somehow resolve it. But actually, we don't realize what is the bath coming with this, how you relate, for example. We just forget this. We just about the philosophical laser sharp explanation. This brings us often even further away from ourselves, from the other. And then we miss, it is not about that. The objective, perfect, absolute explanation that this, and then in this moment,
Yes,
So
I'm.
this even I think with Weidi and cultivating Rag, it's a similar similarity which often happens. And then suddenly we end up in a perfect explanation that actually lost ourselves,
No,
lost each other, the connection
yeah.
with everything.
You
The
got,
grasp of Sanatana Goswami.
yeah. We got stuck from the neck up.
Yes.
What this bar was like. Yeah, like I like to think if someone is, I don't know, going through some loss or suffering and I see someone there crying, it's not the time for me to sit with them and say, like, you know what, I will talk to you about the law of karma.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, I the best thing for me maybe just to sit with the person and be in silence, not even say anything, not trying like, to fix the person, to preach to the person, to convert the person, to just empathy and be, I'm here. You, I hear you, I feel for you. I try to, and that may be way more, give the person a deeper experience than me, like giving the perfect explanation. Because sometimes we think, oh, the perfect explanation solves everything. And you say, no, it's a genuine human empathic experience. It's way better than sometimes thousand words. Sometimes sitting in silence is way more like, gives more of a gift to the other person. That's what the person needs at that moment. We can, maybe there is some time for an explanation, to talk, to philosophize, but sometimes silence is the best option. But not only silence, but as you say, like quality of presence. Like,
Just hold the space.
yeah, holding a space. Exactly. And
And self's also the
that's,
same
yeah, exactly.
issue.
Yeah. Because it's mute, it's
Maybe
always
the answer
relational.
comes through the experience and not through the
Yeah, of
model.
course.
The perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Because you hold space, you allow the person also to go through what they are feeling. So you are not canceling the experience with an explanation. And you allow the person to go through what they need to go through. So when they reach, they go through all that tunnel, so to say, that may seem like an endless dark tunnel. But you hold space for them to, eventually they reach their own conclusion and experience it, which is way more clear and confirming than any explanation we could give. But of course, it is easier to give explanations, more comfortable. And I feel, oh, I did my part, I did the correct thing, rather than sitting uncomfortably in silence with other having to be empathic. Oof, that's big work. Better I give them the perfect formula, and if they don't do it, that's their fault. That's their karma. Again, we go back to the but that's where I think, yeah, we need to become better humans and not that much transcendental to the point that we forgot how to be humans. So fully humans and fully transcendental, they are not opposites. So yeah. And again, we see that all over. Sometimes devotees tell me, oh, Maharaj, but Krishna, the Bhagavad Gita, you're talking about grief. And at the end of the Gita, at the beginning of the Gita, Krishna tells Arjuna, do not grieve, do not lament. First, Krishna said, do not lament for that which is not worthy of lamentation, which indirectly says there's something worthy of lamentation. And then at the end of the Gita and the Mahabharata, where everyone is killed in the, basically almost everyone in the Kurukshetra war, Krishna is performing all these, how do you say, funerary rites. He's crying for every one of the departed ones and grieving. No? The same person that we say he's against grieving and lament. No, he's saying something in certain context, because we can also grieve in excessively for things that could be avoided, but which is unavoidable. You have to go through that. As Krishna himself shown at the end of the Kurukshetra. Sometimes we miss those things. So we take something out of context and make a can we can create a dangerous religion. And without any tradition, this can happen, as you were saying. Right? It's not about Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Christianity, Catholic. It's
Even
about hu
or
it's about yeah, it's about human beings, and we had a great potential for messiness wherever we go. Yeah. So
also just one idea
yeah.
to maybe a little bit close the circle with wonder. Often I know how your experience is. If I just hear you said about just surrender, often my experience was being a monk and everything is okay. I should be someone else. and have to surrender.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm thinking, okay, but actually, if wonder is the basis of love and rasa, in which moments of life am I really really open for wonder? It's not in the moments when I'm dull and I'm full and I'm disconnected. No, when I'm very sensitive and I'm very connected with myself, and then suddenly I have the capacity to see differences and be touched by wonder.
Yeah.
And then especially this polarity of surrender, I'm not myself, I shouldn't be myself, I should be someone else. How wonder can then happen? Because I'm so disconnected.
You have canceled wonder
Yes.
immediately.
And often it's even discovering my uniqueness somehow and maybe in whatever, but now I discover it and I stay on this path. I'm curious, where will I come? This sensitivity and this.
Amen to that. It sounds simple, right? Like I shouldn't try to be someone else, but we are trying that all the time. You cannot be someone else to begin with, but in these attempts of surrendering or becoming whatever idea we have, of course we can grow spiritually and mature and evolve, but on the basis of who we are and on the basis of who we can be now. Because if I'm in utter denial of who I am now, and I'm just want to be this superhero version of myself that I have idealized in my mind, I will never get there if I'm hating all that I am here now. Even if I say I'm a complete mess, I have to have deep acceptance of the mess that I am and work on that to become whatever, right? Because if there's no acceptance, I'm living in delusion. If I do not accept, that's the teaching of the Gita. In the beginning, Krishna is saying, you better perform your dharma imperfectly, that someone else is perfectly. In other words, it's you better be the mess you are than the perfect idea, which is someone else. It's not you, your fictional character in mind. You cannot be that. As much as you think, and no. So start with who you are and wonder is there, as you say, because if I just, I don't know, chastise me for not being as good and as this, and I torture wonder is not coming through that at all. Thank you for that, bringing it back to the wonders. Prasidanitai, raising his hand. We are almost 2 hours. I don't know. Indira decides. Okay.
2 hours.
Maybe we entertain whatever you want to share,
know,
and we can
I
close
thought
with some.
about how important is the human experience for becoming a devotee, or in other words, for going to the spiritual. And what I mean by human experience, the individual human experience according to one's certain karma and nature and adhikar and so on, in order to reach the spiritual, because we see kind of maybe the old mood was you just, like you said, surrender, you become the brahmachari, you follow the cookie cutter program, it doesn't matter what you want or like. So is it
Let me know
kind
how
of
many of
something?
them are remain still functional, balanced
Yeah, that's
people following that.
then you have the other side of the spectrum. Oh no, I like to do this or I like to do that. I don't want some sadhana or something. How important is the unique human experience for you to attain the spiritual goal? You know what I'm trying to say?
I think so. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, and you gave these two extremes of examples,
Right.
so I will say the answer generally lies in the middle point of that,
But
right?
to the deck.
And the middle
And
point is different for every person.
I think the question is, what about that is actually helping
Well,
the spiritual world?
because I will argue very quickly that our spiritual world, because there are many chambers, is Nara Lila. Krishnaraya Tikka Kila Sarbutama Nara Lila. See, Chaitanya Charitamrita. For us, the play of Krishna in Vrindavan, Krishnaraya Tikka Kila Sarbutama Nara. The highest is called Nara Lila. Nara Lila means
Human.
you tell me. Human Lila. So That's my answer in brief. We want to enter to the spirit, yeah, the spiritual world, but in particularly one particular entry point of the spiritual world we know, we call Nara Lila, where everything is human, fully human. We sometimes think, no, that's not fully human. We are fully human. No, we are not fully human. That's fully human. We are bordering inhuman generally. We are not that human many times. No? That's why when what's human? If I tell you, be more human. No, that gives a glimpse of what human means. Human is not the body. The vehicle is behaving in a certain way. That's why you have the verb interesting. You say you are a human being. Being is a verb also. It's not just being human. Human being means being human. And many times you use the word inhuman and you only apply it to humans, which means we have a great potential not to be human as humans. You will never say, oh, what that dog is doing to the cat was inhuman. You will never say inhuman to animals or to rocks or to plants. That was inhuman. You only apply that to humans who do not behave as such. So we have to first before asking how important is humanity, it's like what's humanity? How human I am first. And then understand the goal that I want to attain is fully human, fully divine, but fully human also, the two. That's why we call Nara Lila. If not, it will be called Nara Lila. It will be called something else, Deva Lila, whatever. Nara Lila is human. That was makes Krishna Lila charming, Braja Lila especially charming. And we are not heading for Vaikuntha or whatever or somewhere else. It's the humanness of that. So that's so important for, I will say, I will argue, that's my argument, to preserve our humanness, not only preserve, but explore it, because many times we are not that human. So we can relate more deeply to the humanness of the Lila, along with our practice and our sadhana. I'm not saying just work on your humanity on a psychological, emotional dimension and leave all sadhana behind. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the two go hand by hand. No? So we don't need to, because if not, in the name of going to the spiritual world and being transcendental, you become inhuman. And I've seen that many times. Become dysfunctional, insensitive, not compassionate, evasive, spiritual bypassing all over the place, and all justified. And I'm heading straight for a spiritual world. I don't care for any of this human stuff. Well, you are not going anywhere because the spiritual world you're talking about is full of humanity. So you will not know what to do there if you are not working on your humanity. Like, you will run away, so to say.
The Prayojana is unclear.
Exactly.
What?
That's why it's clear. It's not just saying divine love, spiritual world, Krishna, playing out in what, which are the implications of that. One of them is everything is fully human. Where's how where I am in terms of humanity? I'm half baked human now. I'm fully here. Do I have to heal and work some things in the service of my project, Nara Lila project? It's not just for the sake of my own humanity in a selfish way. It's just in service to my Nara Lila Seva project. It's all integrated in that. So someone may need to heal some childhood trauma. Someone may need to do therapy to be a more aligned human. Okay, that can be done as part of the Nara Lila Seva project. We can call it the Nara Lila Seva Trust. Yeah. And sometimes even one idea came. Some may think that's my speculation, they may be right, but it came. And it came. I was not thinking about it. Which is sometimes still we see, and that's another whole conversation, that's not for today. But some people can be very spiritually advanced, but that can be on some degree humanly dysfunctional. That's possible. At least personally, in the beginning of my journey, I didn't think that was possible. I thought if you are devotionally advanced, you are automatically humanly balanced. It's everything. But sometimes you can be very vertically developed, spiritually vertically, but horizontally not that developed. I've seen many cases. I have some close experience. Sorry?
Find spiritual in that context, because I cannot imagine it's not possible that somebody is spiritually advanced but not connected to other living entities. I don't think it's possible.
No, I'm not saying not connected to other living entities, but
No,
let's say
I'm saying that for
you.
me, spiritual is the connection to other living entities, otherwise, it doesn't make sense.
Okay, then in that case, we are. I mean, that makes sense to me as well. But I'm just saying some people may have some, I don't know, intense practice, intense sadhana. No, I'm starting. But sincerely practicing, trying to practice with their own tools, with their own capacity at that time. But let's say someone has a very, I don't know, dysfunctional situation from childhood that really triggers them in a certain way. But I wouldn't say that that prevents, and they are not conscious even of that because it's so ingrained. But at the same time, there are sincere practitioners and trying to practice and relate. And they are making progress. Bhakti grace is coming, Krishna's grace is coming, but still there is something that has not been healed. That's what I'm referring. And sometimes in relationship to that person, that may be triggered, and it's like, whoa, what was that? I thought that you were spiritually advanced, and therefore you have to respond perfectly to every situation. You follow my?
Yeah.
So that can happen. So I was thinking, okay, so you can say, okay, in some level, your humanity is wounded or harmed, your human psychology. So how can you go to Golok Vrindavan in that way? And I like to think, well, for example, in Raga Bharma Chandrika, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, those who attain prem in this life, they do not go straight to Golok Vrindavan, but they attain birth on earth wherever the Krishna Leela is going on. And they are born in the womb of a gopi, and they're and born in surrounded by eternal associates of Krishna, who are fully human and fully divine. So I'm thinking, okay, if someone became very spiritually advanced in this life, but still there is some human elements not fully healed, okay, they will be born in that environment, and from the womb they will be receiving this samskar from eternal associates who are perfectly human, perfectly divine. Whatever was missing is complete there, and okay, Golok, and you won't make any trouble in Golok with your unbaked, half-baked humanity. But of course, that shouldn't be for me at least an excuse to say, oh, if that's going on, then I don't care for my humanity here. I can just concentrate on being spiritually advanced, and if I'm healed, that will be healed when I'm born in Gokul, whatever that happens. No, I think if we know there is something that I'm getting triggered and I need to heal, that can be part of the, again, Naralila Seva project. And I think we need a lot of that, of trying to integrate human balance with and relationships with others. Not again, not only Krishna and me, rather than Krishna and me, but whole relational spectrum in every direction. How do I relate with my neighbors, myself, my own body, my own mind, the blade of grass? So try to make it. I like more the word, I'm more interested in the word integration than transcendence, to be honest. Because transcendence for me, I have nothing against the word transcendence. But how it has been used at times, it sounds more like I want to leave this place as soon as possible and get it like a rocket to Golok. And integration for me is like I want to become wholesome. I want to become not only holy, but whole, no, with double B. For that, I need to deal with my holes, with the holes, to make a play of words. Wholeness and holiness, no? The two of them combined.
Seems there are two extremes, like you want to go too fast, trying to just, and the other one who playing, no, first I have to become fully human, and they are not picking up the spiritual practice.
That's why I began the answer saying those are two extremes. So hopefully we can. They have some questions as well.
They agree.
They agree? Okay, because that may sound like an argument also, like we don't like what you say. Yeah, that's why the Bhagavatam say nanirvino. No, one does not attain perfection if bhakti in bhakti. Bhakti yoga siddhida na. You don't attain bhakti siddhi. Nanirvino na ati ashakto. If you are too detached, no, you don't attain perfection. If you are too attached, you do not attain perfection. Like implying, try always to find a middle point. Let's not try to go to extremes of anything, right? Like balance is always, and balance is always changing also, right? It's not that balance is, okay, I found the middle point. That's it. I'm going to rest. First of all, the middle point of each one is different, and your own middle point will be shifting along the journey so many times. So it's a daily vigilance. Okay, what's my middle point? Not even today, now. Later today, I have to see again, right? Because if we don't pay attention to that, eventually, oh, how I ended up here? I ended up there. Yeah, honoring the individuality at every day, on every stage, and the journey unfolding. Because again, if not, we make this formula. Okay, this is the middle point, end of the conversation. There's so much happening. Okay, I think we can put the sharing to rest. Somehow, I ended up talking a lot about what I was supposed to be talking about, but also, we wanted to open the space for whatever you were to talk, wanted to share. So, thank you for your questions and your presence and your friendship and everything. Beautiful place. Thanks for bringing us here today. Let me show it with the camera for those who will be seeing the recording. Now wondering. Here we are. And here they are.
Done.
Jai Shriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Shri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari Hari Om.